Welcome to Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller. Our guest today is Mark Conlock. He is the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and we'll be talking to him about holistic landscape design. Well, Mark Conlock, thank you so much for coming all the way down from Green Bay today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Before we start talking about holistic design, why don't you tell us about the Green Bay Botanical Gardens? I don't know if a lot of people have gone, especially from other areas of the state. So what's it all about?
Yeah, you should definitely come and visit us in Green Bay. We've been there since 1996, so
okay.
Pretty young garden,
yes.
Still. But we do have 23 and a half acres of developed garden, so that makes us, you know, pretty good size, actually.
It's very big. I have to tell you a quick little story. Larry and I were live last year from the Botanical Garden, and I wasn't thinking we were going to be touring the garden, and Larry's like, let's just go and see the garden while I had heels on. And so I know it's big. It's definitely big. Yeah.
Yeah. So we have about 60,000 plants, perennials, trees, and shrubs of about 3,300 different kinds.
Wow.
So all things you can grow in your yard in Wisconsin, you know, that's hardy to zone 4, zone 5 border,
mm-hmm.
which is where we are. We have a lot of great gardens, which you can see, you know, on our website, the different look of them. But we have our formal upper gardens, I call it, and then our lower gardens. We have a really big shade garden. And last year, we just installed our Donald J. Schneider Family Grand Garden, which is a huge outdoor amphitheater, where we have our concert series and new concerts coming online. And that was about 11,000 perennials and 1,000 trees and shrubs.
Oh, my.
Yeah, and a lot of those were the native plants. And that's kind of how we started to think about the holistic landscape design and the sustainability side of things a little more.
Yeah.
I mean, we were already, but on a larger scale, we could really install it and make an impact on our landscape.
Well, that's a great segue, Mark. So why don't you explain a little bit about holistic landscape design? Because I don't know if a lot of people have actually heard that term.
Yeah, and it's kind of something I just heard and kind of took over a little bit. But to me, it is like when you think about your designing your landscape in your yard or your house, you kind of think about, okay, well, what's the function of my area going to be? You know,
right.
What problem am I solving? Do I want a patio? Do I want to screen my neighbor off?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what do I want exactly? And then you think, well, I'm going to use plants to solve this problem. So I want, you know, like a privet hedge, or I want, you know, whatever. Back they used to use honeysuckle or, you know, things like that that were invasive species eventually, or burning bush, which is now on that NR40 list. So then the next step is not just thinking about, you know, that you're going to use a plant, but what is that specific plant? Of course, you'd think about that anyway, but then, you know, the color, the texture, when does it bloom? But then the next step, the holistic side of it is like, okay, well, what plant is maybe native to Wisconsin? If I go to some of these resources, can I find out a plant that more insects use that's then the bottom of the food chain where, you know, birds would eat the caterpillars, or it's used for habitat in some fashion? So that's kind of the holistic side of then, because then a lot of those plants don't need any extra fertilizer, extra water. You don't have to spray them with an insecticide or treat them for anything. So then you're really dampening your effect on the environment, and you're picking a plant that actually adds to the environment.
Right.
So the kind of the weird thing about thinking about it, though, is like a lot of our plants are, you know, insect resistant, and you actually have to think the opposite. You want something that the insect is going to eat, and you have to live with the damage of it. So it's kind of like, you know, weirdly contrarian to what we think about for landscaping in some ways.
It's a little bit of a different mindset.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and how does that relate then to the whole, ecosystem with animals also?
Yeah, well, we have some really cool interpretive signs that we were able to put in the Grand Garden with funding from the Wild Ones.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and it
great organization.
Yeah, and pretty much what we were showing was like, you know, if you have a plant, well, it's taking up, you know, the sun's energy, photosynthesizing and becoming food. Well, if nothing can eat it, then the energy stops at that plant and it doesn't get taken up the food chain. So in essence, you're kind of cutting off the sun's energy, you know, at the plant. So instead, if you pick something, you know, that can be used by multiple insects, then it gets eaten by birds or other animals, and then those become food and the whole energy goes up the food chain. And you have more diversity and more biodiversity in your landscape. And, you know, according to all that information, like Doug Talamy, Bringing Nature Home,
right.
You know, if everyone doesn't include those kinds of plants in their landscapes, it seems like it's going to be hard, you know, for us to actually have enough biodiversity, you know, on the planet. So it's like a small way that you can actually make a difference. You know,
right.
And a lot of times we're like, we can't do anything, but you can if you just incorporate, you know, these native plants.
Right, exactly. And I know a lot of our listeners are very interested in getting pollinators to their yard. Is that some of the things that you think about, too, when you're selecting plants for the botanical garden?
Yeah, especially with that Grand Garden Project. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those plants are plants that pollinators use. And then, of course, you don't have to use any insecticides and things, so you're not actually killing your pollinators off. There's a couple really good resources that people could use when they're trying to find their plants that we found when we were doing our project and that we put on that interpretive signage.
Okay.
And one's actually Doug Tallamy helped work with the National Wildlife Federation, and they have this plant finder, and you type in your zip code, and then it'll tell you the plants that are native to that zip code, and then how many, you know, butterflies and caterpillars use it. So it's a really good way where you can say, okay, well, you know, this plant, if I have to pick one plant for my yard, I might want to pick the one that more insects use, because then it's, you know, more biodiversity in general.
Right.
And then the other one I wanted to mention was Illinois Wildflowers. If you type that in and search it, I think it's illinoiswildflowers.info.
Okay.
Dr. John Hilty did kind of a similar thing. I mean, a lot of the wildflowers in Illinois are in Wisconsin, too.
Oh, sure.
And they have all the different insects that use them, so you can, like, count it up. And we did that for our signage. And it was kind of crazy because, like, Rattlesnake Master, they found 189 different insects use that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so that was, like, if you can live with the texture and the look and all the other design criteria,
uh-huh.
You know, that would be, like, the one plant you would want to put for the most insects.
Wow, that's a great way of looking at it, because I think we always kind of go in the other direction. We don't think about the bugs first. We think about the look. But yeah, that's kind of neat. So, and why don't you give us again those two, because I know people are going to be calling and ask, what was he talking about? So tell us the two sources again.
Yeah, the one source for that that Doug Tallamy helped out with was the National Wildlife Federation Plant Finder.
Okay.
And if you search that, you'll get to that. And then you type in your zip code, mm-hmm. and then it gives you a list of plants, and it can be trees and shrubs or perennials and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And the other one is Illinois Wildflowers, and I believe it's .info.
Okay.
I just looked it up before I came on air, actually.
Yeah, great. Excellent. Well, we are talking to Mark Conlock. He's the gardening expert today. He's the director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. We're going to go to Joe in Sun Prairie first. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good morning. Everything's fine with me. I've got a question concerning, I have my back lot is completely tree covered and shady. So what I've tried to do over the years is cultivate the various moss species back there. And my battle is, how do I keep the weeds out of the moss without hurting the moss? Because I have no idea what kind of herbicides you can use on moss.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Joe. I guess, you know, one thing we do at our garden, which you might not like to hear, is that we have a lot of volunteers and we almost pull all of our weeds by hand. So we don't really use herbicides except like on large swaths of areas that are being taken over for new garden development. So, you know, if you go in there and pull the weeds without damaging your moss, that might, you know, be one place to start. You know, one good thing in general with the weeds is to get them before they set seed, so at least they don't propagate further and you stop your problem, you know, from getting larger. Of course, you have weeds that spread by rhizomes and that kind of thing. So, you know, beyond that, you'd have to look and see if there is something labeled for whatever type of weed you have, like if it's a broadleaf weed, you know, that doesn't affect moss. So it's a bit of a specialized, you know, thing. So you might have to do some investigating to see, or maybe you could use, you know, like a vinegar solution or something on the, you know, the weed versus the moss, you know, but it would be, you definitely want to try not to get it on your moss to do any damage to that.
That's kind of tricky. But Joe, good luck with that. And, you know, let us know how that goes, because I think moss gardens are absolutely gorgeous. Do you have anything like that in Green Bay?
We don't have a moss garden, but we have a plan for an Asian woodland garden that would have a moss garden. And the other place that Joe might want to talk to is Rotary Botanic Garden, because they have a pretty cool moss garden there. And Mark Dwyer might have, you know, some advice on what to do or how they keep the weeds out of there.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. And Cindy in Baraboo is up next. Hi, Cindy.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I planted some strawberry plants a few years ago, and they don't seem to be thriving where I'm at. I think that maybe it gets too much moisture by a retaining wall, I'm not being able to keep up the weeding like I should either, and I'm wondering about putting them in a raised bed or into like a kiddie pool or something like that. And would they thrive that way?
Well, I think usually with the strawberries, you do have to kind of refresh them every so many years, you know, and kind of like either dig them out and re-space them, or it might be easier just to, you know, destroy the one that's all full of weeds and then buy new strawberry plants and put them at the correct spacing, you know, and redo it. I like your idea of the raised bed, actually, because that way you can control the soil that you're growing in. You can have it a little more well-drained if you think you need to, and then, you know, you'll be able to manage it better and take care of it and mulch it and everything higher. So I think that's your best bet. I don't know about the kiddie pool thing. You possibly could use it as that, but you know, it might not insulate the roots as much, and the roots are the least hardy part of a plant, you know, so that part might get damaged compared to a raised bed that's a little thicker. You know, that might be your issue with the raised bed too. But the other thing about the kiddie pool is make sure that if you do, you know, try that, that you drill holes in the bottom, because you need it to drain. Otherwise, it'll just be like a giant trough and it'll hold, you know, your soil and strawberries, but also water, and they'll become really inundated. So I think what you need to do is redo your strawberry bed, you know, either take them apart and space them out, the ones you have, or buy new ones. And then your raised bed idea, I think, is something worth trying out.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much for that question, Cindy. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Mark Conlock. He is the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. You're listening to Garden Talk. Now we're going to go right back to the phones. We've got Jeff in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a question. I have about an acre of land. It's kind of a back lot, and it has oak wilt in it. And so I've been removing the dead oak trees. And I have in the understory a burning bush tree. As best as I could identify it, it has fins on the bark, and it's about 2 inches in diameter. And I was wondering if I should remove it or leave it. And also, I have a lot of honeysuckle in the understory where it just makes that you can't even walk through the area. And I wanted to eradicate that and put a different type of understory in, as well as the replacement for the oak trees.
Okay, well, that sounds like a job, Mark. What is your suggestion for him?
Yeah, well, you have a big project there, Jeff, for sure. It sounds like you're doing, you know, the right thing. I would definitely get rid of the burning bush, because I know, you know, it and certain cultivars of it are on that Wisconsin Administrative Code NR40, you know, list of prohibited and restricted plants. And we have found that, like, in our botanical garden in Green Bay, we used to have a burning bush hedge around our herb garden, and we removed it because of that fact. But we still have found seedlings, you know, out in the woods when we clear for new garden projects, and we only really had 20 of those plants on our property. And the same with the honeysuckle plants, you'll want to get rid of those too. So sometimes the honeysuckles that are small, you can literally just rip out of the ground, and they have that weed wrench, you know, tool that you can use to kind of rip them out of the ground. Or the other thing that we do is we'll, you know, cut those stems and then daub them with herbicide. And a good time to do that is usually, you know, kind of in the late summer, fall, when they're translocating their energy down into the root system, because then it'll take that herbicide down and also help kill the root system a little bit better. So first of all, yeah, you got to get rid of all that stuff. You know, your issue is going to be an ongoing one, because you'll have seeds of those, you know, and then that once you clear all that stuff, it brings light to the forest floor, and then all of them germinate again. So sometimes, you know, when they all germinate, it's better to use a spray herbicide at a lower concentration that you spray the whole, you know, new layer of your honeysuckle with. But you could plant some desirables in there, like you said. So in our woods, we have a lot of pagoda dogwood in our understory, you know, which has that horizontal branching structure. It's a nice native plant with spring flowers and some decent purplish red fall color. Viburnum trilobum, high bush cranberry viburnum, is a nice one to plant. It has, again, spring flowers that are white. It has the kind of cranberry red fruit. It has really nice fall color. There's arrowwood viburnums you could use. And all those can take a little bit of part shade. There's also Viburnum prunifolium. And the kind of interesting thing, you might want to check Johnson's Nursery down in Menominee Falls, because they have some selections of some of those that are a little more ornamental, but seem to retain the characteristics, you know, of the natives that are desirable in terms of them being habitat and holistic kind of design type thing. So it sounds like, you know, you have a challenge, but also maybe an opportunity to make a really nice habitat.
Yes, definitely. Look at it as an opportunity. It's much easier to face that. And what should he do when he takes those burning bush and the honeysuckle out? What does he do to dispose of those? What's the best way?
That's a good question. We usually just throw them on our brush pile, but since most people don't have it, you know, if it doesn't have fruit and things like that, I assume you could probably bring it to your local, you know, municipal place that has the yard waste recycling. And a lot of those places have, you know, good chippers, and then they might compost it to kill those weed seeds. But that's a good thing, Jill, to think about, because you don't want to spread them around. So sometimes, you know, some land managers like to cut them and leave them in place and then deal with the seedlings that come up, you know, so that's something Jeff might have to think about instead of dragging it potentially to other sites of your property and then spreading the problem.
Sure.
You know, so then at least you know where those seedlings are going to be.
Right. Okay. Well, good luck, Jeff. Up next, we have William in Milwaukee. Hi, William.
Hi there.
What's your question?
Well, I've been growing some potatoes recently, and I've been actually having... They were actually pretty late sprouters since I planted them before we had that snowstorm in April.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I planted them just around, like, the first day of spring.
Okay.
And while they're pretty good size, I did try and check, you know, one of the larger plants and, you know, about a month ago, and the potatoes were only about, I would best describe as smaller than a golf ball.
Hmm. Okay.
I mean, this is supposed to be, you know, proper russet potatoes, you know, so it's... I mean, do you think the cold might have had an effect on them? You know, I mean, I buried them like 3 or 4 inches deep, so hopefully that was enough.
Yeah.
Is there anything I can do to help them?
Well, you might want to look and see if, you know, you should apply any type of fertilizer. I'm not an expert potato grower, but that might be something to look into. The other thing to think, a couple things to think about would be, you know, make sure if it doesn't rain, they get enough water. You know, so that there were some really dry periods this summer, so it would have been good to keep them watered. And actually, as they keep growing throughout the season, if it doesn't, you know, rain during the dog days of August here, I would definitely give them some supplemental water, because, you know, I'm guessing a pretty good chunk of a potato is water content. And then the other thing to do probably is to mound, you know, soil up on top of your plant, because you can keep doing that as it's growing throughout the season, then it'll actually produce more potatoes as well. So couple things to check. Make sure you keep it watered, especially if it doesn't rain. And as it's producing, you know, the fruit, make sure it's well irrigated. Check into maybe doing a little bit of fertilization and then mound some soil up on top of it too.
All right. Let's go now to Alex in Appleton. Alex, what can we help you with?
So it's kind of a question and putting the thought in people's minds and hoping that someone will reach out to me. So I live in the city. And I'm very lucky. I have a completely 100% wooded lot, literally. You cannot see my house right now. And I have a terrace on the side of my property. I live on a corner lot, and it's 150 feet long by about 5 feet wide. And right now it's currently grass. And what I want to do is I want to transform that whole entire area to be planted with plants and things like that for butterflies and moths and other pollinators and things that are good for our environment that we need. However, I don't have the funds to do something like that because it's a lot of property and it takes a lot of money, and I don't want to do it by seed because that could take forever. It might not ever take off. So I already did reach out to the DNR, and they also have a thing about the, the Department of Natural Resources Species Management, and there's a Wisconsin Monarch Collaborative, seeing if there's anything What happens is that there's people out there that would love to do something that I want to do, and they have the funds to do it, but they don't have the property. I have the property. I don't have the funds. And they said that, you know, grants and things like that are only given for huge public spaces, acres upon acres. So I ask, is there anything that you've heard of people who say, hey, I have the money but not the property. I would love to be able to do this so that we can work together.
Have you heard of anything that could help her out?
You know, what I might do is contact, say, the Wild Ones. You know, they might be interested in having, you know, alternate sites where they can show kind of a lot like that out in a city landscape. Otherwise, you know, you could, maybe some ways to do it for less money would be to collect seeds. You know, I think the Wild Ones has collecting, you know, teaching workshops and everything where you could collect the seed instead of buying it and then spread it out on that site and then, you know, see what happens.
And she was concerned that it might take too long for the seeds or they wouldn't actually start growing.
Yeah, the other place to look, you know, of course, you'd still have to spend money, of course, but Prairie Nursery, you know, has plants for sale and sometimes they have like smaller bundles of plants than like a big plant. They have some pre-designed gardens that you can buy. It kind of brings up an interesting point, though, like not just the cost part of it, but I heard at a Wild Ones conference, actually, in Oshkosh, one of the Mariani brothers from Mariani Nursery in Chicago was talking about a study that Michigan State University did where it showed when people moved homes, like if you produce a really nice prairie in your yard, you know, people move so often, the next homeowner doesn't appreciate that, you know, ecology of that.
Yes.
And they a lot of times will take it out. So the idea of sustainability over time was what he was talking about. So one of the things to think about is maybe using the native plants, but kind of organizing them in more of a garden fashion, you know, groups of plants so it looks like a garden, or even incorporating some ornamental plants within that garden space. And then that might help that area last, you know, longer if Alex ever moves.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, so I think she should try, you know, maybe reaching out to the Wild Ones as her first step.
Sure, and they might be able to help you with somebody else, too. So good luck, Alex, and thank you for trying to do that. Up next, we have Alyssa from Almond. Lots of alliteration today. Hi, Alyssa. What's your question?
Hi. All throughout June, we are visited by the Rose Shaper Skeletonizers, and they visit our asparagus, grapes, apples, cherries, plums, everything. We just got this property less than 2 years ago, so we're still learning its plants. And we just go out there by hand and pluck for like 2 hours every night in June,
oh,
a little bit into July, every night. These Rose Shaper Skeletonizers who will make lace out of every single leaf and start attacking the fruit, the young fruit. I talked to a nursery and they gave me their very last castor bean plant. So this is a plant apparently that it's an annual, but you can easily reseed it by saving its seeds. And then the Skeletonizers will eat it, and then it's toxic. The oils are toxic in their bodies, and it'll kill them. I haven't planted it, though, because we have bees. So I'm just in a conundrum.
Well, you're not the only one, Alyssa. We've had a lot of people calling about those rose chafers, and castor beans are very, I believe, poisonous to people, too, so be careful with those. But what do you think she should be doing?
Yeah, well, I'm not an expert on the rose skeletonizer for sure, but what I would probably do was, you know, of course you can call your extension agent to see what they recommend. And then, you know, a lot of, maybe there's some type of systemic, you know, insecticide that you can apply that would be taken up. And then, you know, like you said, of course, everything that eats on that leaf would be killed, but they would kill your skeletonizer. A lot of times what we like to do, it seems like it might take a little bit of time, but, you know, like I said, we don't spray many insecticides, and we used to have the rose slug a lot at the botanical garden, and we would spray, you know, for that every kind of early June, and we don't do that for the last maybe 5-6 years, but we feel like maybe because we don't do any hardly insecticide treatments that we have a lot of beneficial insects that then have come up and kind of kept that population in check. So maybe, you know, it depends with fruit and things like that, because you're really trying to get a crop, you know, you might want to try to, is there a way maybe you can exclude them by, you know, covering things like that? But I would definitely look at the extension agent. and see what they say first. Like you said, the castor bean is a beautiful ornamental plant, but it is highly toxic to humans, like all parts of it. And, you know, the seeds are what they use to make ricin. So you might want to be a little careful about
It's dangerous stuff. Very dangerous stuff, for sure. And I think we've had guests on the show before who've mentioned the row covers. Picking them off every night. Wow, what a fun thing to do every night this summer. Okay, thank you, Alyssa. Hopefully we had some good answers there for you, and good luck. We're talking with Mark Conlock. He's our gardening expert today, and he's from the Green Bay Botanical Garden. He's the director of horticulture there. We had Joyce from Wanakee email us to ask whether commercial sprays for mosquitoes affect the growth and flowering of plants in a yard, like your flowers and bushes. Do you know about the effects of those?
I haven't heard about them affecting, you know, the growth of plants ever at all.
Yeah, I haven't either. So I'm wondering where she could go to find out, maybe from the city or...
Well, one thing would be to read the label, you know, of the chemical. It should tell you on there a little bit of what, you know, effects it would have on plant growth. Of course, there's the internet.
You could look it up on there. What a great idea. That'll be putting us out of business one of these days. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ken in Marinette County calling in. Hi, Ken.
Good morning. I have a question on tomatoes. I got tomato blight. Seems like wherever I plant them.
Oh.
New ground, even, it seems like. I had a little success this year with putting mulch or grass clippings around them. And it doesn't seem to be as bad, but I still have it. And I was wondering if there's anything else I could do.
Well, it sounds like you're doing, you know, like a good thing would be to cover the soil surface so that you don't have, you know, anything splashing up onto your leaves, you know, that would spread the blight. I think you're on the right track, you know.
It's difficult to get rid of once you get
it. Yeah, if you have it, then you probably want to just try to harvest, you know, what you can as it comes, and then get rid of the infected plant when it's too far gone, and make sure that you remove all of that debris so that it doesn't overwinter, you know, in your soil and become a problem the next year. Of course, the other thing to think about doing is rotating your crops and having them in a different spot of your garden the following year so that you, you know, reduce the impact of any blight that might have been there from previous years.
What do you think about container gardening for tomatoes? Would that make sense as an option? I mean, depending on how many has, obviously.
Right, yeah, that would be a really good idea, because then you can control the environment, you can control where it's growing, and you can, you know, move it around to more sun or whatever you need for the right conditions.
Yeah, okay. Well, keep up the good work there, Ken. Next up, we have Marion in Windsor. Hi, Marion.
Yes. I am wondering about lettuce. I've been growing lettuce for quite a long time, and it's not always in the same place. I do rotate a lot, and it doesn't taste very good this year. It's kind of bitter, even from smaller onto the larger. I know that, you know, it starts getting more bitter as it bolts and that kind of thing. But I'm wondering if I need something in my soil, possibly.
I don't think so. I think you probably hit it on the head that, you know, as the temperatures warm, you know, and as it gets to be older, then it starts to taste more bitter. So what you could consider doing is, you know, having successive crops of it, you know, starting some seeds at different weeks in the springtime so that you have, you know, different age plants. But as it gets warmer, that will happen, I think, no matter what. But the thing you can start thinking about now, or in the next, you know, maybe whatever, 3 weeks, is seeding a new crop that will be ready for harvest in the late summer, fall-ish, that'll be cooler, and then you'll have the good tasting lettuce again in the cool part of, you know, this late summer fall.
Well, could the ground that she's planting it in have any effect on the taste then of the lettuce, or the amount of water that it gets?
Possibly, I guess, but I would think, you know, a lot of it has to do with the cultivar of the lettuce too, and it seems like the heat is really the big thing that people always comment on that causes that effect of the taste.
Yeah, we've had plenty of heat, that's for sure, and humidity. Let's go back to the phones, and we've got Bob in Verona with a problem. Hi, Bob.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. Speaking of Prairie Farms, I did order one of those pollinator native plant gardens earlier this year and planted it in early June, And I live in a subdivision and a lot of rabbits around, and I did put a fence around it, but those little buggers have managed to, I think, get under there and eaten the tops off my purple coneflowers, my milkweed, and probably a couple other plantings. Do you know if that has killed those plantings, that they'll need to be, I'll need to reorder and replant, because nothing's coming up?
Oh, yeah. So they've been eaten completely to the ground, Bob?
Yeah. Yep.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not a good thing, obviously. No. But, you know, like you said, there's the above ground part, the stems, there's the crown of the plant and the roots. So depending on how, you know, significant of a root system it had, you know, the plant, the crown and the roots can still be alive, and it can produce, you know, more shoots and try to continue growing, you know, this summer. If you don't see that happening, then you would more than likely need to replace the plants and, you know, start fresh with those ones that have been chewed down to the ground. Because in essence, it's like when you're, you know, some weed control methods are you keep cutting the plant down as it grows and you let it grow itself to death. So unfortunately, your rabbits have kind of like cut it down for you. So it should try to keep growing if it has energy in the roots and the crown of the plant, and then it would come back. And if you can exclude those rabbits, you know, then you might be okay. But if it doesn't come back after a little bit, I would probably buy some more plants so that you can get established in a timely manner too. One thing we do for the rabbits at our place is we spray that liquid fence. You know, the kind of putrescent garlic and egg mixture.
Yeah, it smells great.
Yeah, it doesn't smell good, but it works pretty decently at the Green Bay Botanical Garden.
Does
we
it?
Spray it on our bulbs, actually. Once we plant them in the ground, we spray it on the ground until the ground freezes, and then we spray it on our tulip bulbs as they start to emerge in the spring and all spring long. And then we've started to use it on our rose trialing. We do some sustainable rose trialing, and last fall, the deer ate the tops of our flowers right when we were evaluating, so we use it now on that sustainable rose trial on a weekly basis since we have a deer on the property.
Okay, so the deer don't like it either.
Yeah, it's a deer and rabbit repellent.
Wow. And again, the name?
It's Liquid Fence is the one
Liquid
that we use.
Liquid Fence, okay. Because I know we did have, I think it was Matt in Wausau had emailed that he was having problems with the deer too, so maybe that would help. Do you have to reapply it after rain, or is it just once a week?
We do it, you know, weekly. You're supposed to. It's supposed to be pretty rain resistant if it's been on there and dried a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And then the bottle does tell you to, you know, spray it for a couple weeks, and then you can have a longer time period.
Okay.
But we like to just do it weekly to do our due diligence protect it as best as we
uh-huh.
can.
Okay. Well, I'm sure a lot of people will take that advice because we've got an awful lot of rabbits down here. I don't know about up in Green Bay, but they are everywhere this year. Okay. So thanks, Bob, for that question. And next we have Mary in Appleton. Hello, Mary.
Hi, and this also needs to be deer for deer that they don't like. I'm interested in an espaliered idea or a vine to put against maybe a 6-foot high retaining wall where there's a lot of shade, a little bit of sun. Do you have any ideas? And I could even put up some wire along the wall. To help train it.
Yeah, I think I have a couple of ideas that should work. Virginia creeper, you know, that's a native plant to Wisconsin. It grows sometimes in the understory, you know, in somewhat shade, part shaded environments. The other one might be Boston ivy. You know, you could probably try that. There's also that climbing hydrangea vine that's, you know, can take a little bit of shade. It might not be as floriferous, you know, in the shade compared to full sun, but it should be able to take a little bit of shade. So depending on how shady it is, you know, the Virginia creeper.
And that's a beautiful vine.
Yeah, yeah, and it has really mm-hmm. nice fall color. It gets really red. It's like bucky red, actually.
Bucky red. I never thought of it that way, but I guess it is.
Yeah, there's Dutchman's pipe. I think that can take a little bit of shade. That's a native vine. You know, it might be a little challenging to train it up a retaining wall. The other thing that might grow, it likes full sun better, is hops.
Oh.
You know, that's a pretty
yeah.
vigorous vine.
So would it do okay in the shade?
Well, I think it's more of a full sun vine, but if
right.
it, depending on how part shady it is, you know, you might be able to get that established.
And it grows really fast, so maybe shade would just make it grow slower. Oh, who knows, right?
Yeah, yeah, but the Virginia creeper might be your best bet to try.
Okay, well, try that, Mary. Let us know how that works out for you, because I think a lot of people probably have that same problem that they like to solve. Next up is Kate in Wausau. Hello, Kate.
Hi. I want to say, first of all, Jill, you do a really, really nice job. I would hire you at my radio station.
Well, thank you. That's so lovely of you to say. What can we help you with?
I have three questions. One is this: the deer, not the deer, with my radishes, I have a lot of greens. The greens are tall, and the base of the green is thick, and the radish is either very small or huge. And also, why can't I grow beets? And third is, what about those deer and hosta? What do you do with that?
Okay, lots of questions.
Yeah, lots of good questions.
Thank you, Kate.
Well, I'll try my best here. The radishes, well, I mean, first of all, they're more of a cool season crop. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly, but I would guess that you might be having problems, you know, because it's starting to get to be the summer time of the year. So I would, and they grow so fast, what I would do is just replant them, you know, kind of in late August, you know, so that you have a crop in the fall that will be then, again, with kind of like the lettuce question, that it'll be being ready to be harvested in the cool part of the year, and then it should be putting its energy into making, you know, the root, the part that you eat again. So that's what I would do on those. I wouldn't worry too much about it. You might need to put a little bit of fertilizer in your soil, but that's, you know, probably not necessary even, is my guess, depending on if, you know, how much you've cropped that particular part of your landscape. Trouble growing beets? Not sure exactly, but you should be able to grow those, you know, in Wisconsin.
Oh yeah,
again,
lots of people,
you know,
grow beets.
Like, it'll look cool. Mm-hmm. One, you know, that brings up a good point though, Kate, is like, if you go to the All America Selections you know, website and look for that logo of the All America Selection winners, there was a beet recently that became an All America Selection winner, and those have been trialed at all the sites, you know, throughout the country, and they're usually easier to grow, you know, for homeowners, more disease resistant, you know, more insect resistant, produce better crops. So if you look for that AAS winning logo, I know there was a recent winner of a beet.
Okay.
That you might want to try out. Maybe that'll work better for you. And then the deer on the hosta, well, that's kind of like their thing. They love those.
They do.
Guys, you know, you can try to exclude the deer somehow. You know, that's always challenging because you have to have a fence that a deer won't go over.
They're smart.
Yeah, they're smart. We were just at a home, the King's Actual Garden in Green Bay. They're the ones that donated the money for our shade garden. And they have this really neat, it's like an 8-foot fence around their yard that you can't really see because it's like that black plastic mesh. It's like really thin,
mm-hmm.
you know, so it kind of disappears into the landscape.
Yes.
And it really seems to keep the deer out, you know, of a yard. You know, if you have a huge property or a garden that you don't want to have a weird fence around, that might, you know, not look good.
Right.
You could try the liquid fence thing, you know, or other deer repellents. Like, there's other different ones out on the market. The trouble with those, of course, is you have to reapply them a lot. The other thing you could try is maybe growing other plants around there, you know, that might deter a deer, but a lot of times they seem to find what they like to eat.
Yeah, I've heard marigold. I don't know if that would work in this case, but yeah. But hopefully we gave you some suggestions there, Kate, so good luck. This is Garden Talk. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network, and we're talking with Mark Conlock. He is the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and we are talking about holistic landscaping, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Garden Talk. With Mark Conlock from the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And for those who may want to go in and just to check it out, how to find you, what's your website?
It's gbbg.org.
So G for green and B for bay and B for botanical and G for garden. So, okay, we got it. So let's go back to the phones right now. We've got Elise up next. She is in Sheboygan. Hello, Elise.
Hello.
What's your question?
So my question is about my peony plants. I have two of them, and they seem to develop fine in the spring, and the buds come out. The flowers even do develop fine, but then the leaves get this coating on them. The whole plant is actually covered, and I'm wondering if it's some type of fungus, and if so, how I would treat that.
Does it look kind of powdery?
It does.
So do you think it's like a powdery mildew maybe? Is it in a kind of part shaded environment, or is it full sun? Or I mean,
they're full sun where they sit, but it's covering both of the plants in their entirety.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, well, it sounds like it's, you know, some type of mildew. So we don't really treat ours for those kinds of things, you know, but you can, you know, go to the store and find a product to probably use on it, but a lot of times what's causing it is, you know, you have to have the pathogen there, you have to have a plant susceptible, and then the right environment. So you might be able to control your environment. One thing is make sure, you know, you don't overhead water. Of course, if it rains, that's what overhead watering does.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is to try to get airflow, you know, through them so that they can dry out so that you don't have that water film on there where the fungus can grow. So depending on how large they are, you could consider, you know, dividing them eventually in the fall. You know, that's a little challenging because they have huge, you know, kind of tuberous root systems, and you need to make sure that you plant them the same depth and all that kind of thing. So, I mean, you are getting the flower, which is the main thing of the peony, and they're doing good. It's just that, does that happen every year?
Last year was the first year, and now it did it again this year. So now 2 years in a row.
Okay, well, so maybe, you know, since it's just a recent development, what you probably for sure should do is this fall when you clean it up, you know, make sure you get rid of all of that foliage, kind of like we were talking about with some of the other, you know, the other diseases, because then you won't have that around to come back on the next year. So you're kind of like getting that disease triangle, you're getting rid of the pathogen. So that's, you know, kind of one small thing you could do is make sure you just get rid of all those leaves this fall, and, you know, maybe don't even compost them, just throw them away or get them off site somewhere. Maybe you can help reduce the incidence of it that way.
Should you cut that right down to the ground then?
Yeah, that's what I would do. Cut it really close to the ground.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. Good luck, Elise. Thank you for the call. Next up is Cindy in Lake Mills. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, I got a cucumber plant that was like in a 3-inch pot that was a little guy, and I potted my plants in larger plants with brand new Miracle Grow vegetable and flower soil, so it was all new, and peat moss. And I potted them in big pots, and then I got a trellis because I wanted to put them on the porch so that they would grow there instead of having to have a garden, because nobody likes to help weed. And
well, that's
it
a surprise.
Grew double its size. Yeah, it grew double its size, and then all of a sudden it started getting, you know, its little flowers and everything, and I thought, great, it's doing great. And then it just stopped growing and nothing, and now it's turning yellow and doing absolutely nothing.
That doesn't sound
and
good.
It's got holes in the bottom. I mean, it's got good drainage.
How big is your pot, Cindy?
It's a huge pot. I mean, I gave it a huge pot. It's a great big pot, the biggest one I had. I mean, it's as big as a steering wheel.
Okay.
Okay, well, so, you know, sometimes they can have a lot of the same symptoms of overwatering versus underwatering. So make sure you let it dry out between waterings if you haven't already done that. Make sure it gets enough sun. You know, it really needs a lot of sun to produce the fruit on there. And, I mean, it sounds like you have enough fertilizer and that type of thing. So you want to be careful you don't over-fertilize it, actually.
Right,
because
that could be a problem.
The other way. So, you know, kind of funny thing, but maybe you just want to go to the farmer's market and buy some cucumbers.
It's not as much fun, but it is simpler for sure. Yeah, I guess because I've heard too, you know, if it's yellow, it's usually too much water or not enough, right?
Yeah, so. Right. How is your watering of it, Cindy?
You know, well, I let it drain and I put my finger in it, and then when it's really dry, then I water it. But,
right,
you know, we're getting rain all day today, unfortunately.
Right.
But
right,
I do let it drain out, and then when it's really dry, I stick my finger in it, and it's dry, and then I water it.
Right.
You know, and my tomato plant is doing wonderful because I planted it in the same size, and it grew, and it's as tall as the, you know, I bought it the same size.
Yeah.
And it's as tall as the cage. And I got two tomatoes
so far, but they're still green.
Well, but, you know, Cindy, I've never had good luck with cucumbers in a container ever, and tomatoes will do fine. So I don't know if that has something to do with it or not.
You know, one thing, Cindy, I just thought of with Jill talking about that is you might, next time you try it, you might want to get a cucumber that's bred specifically for container culture.
That's true.
I think there's one, an AAS winner actually called Diva. There might be, I think that one's a container one. If not, there are other ones on the market that are bred for, like, you know, that container growing. So maybe that, you know, maybe that'll help next time. And I guess that is the thing of gardening. You know, you're not always successful, unfortunately.
No. Yeah.
So chalk that one up as a lesson learned, I guess.
Yep. Experimentation. Thank you, Cindy. We appreciate that call. And going back to the phones, we have Brent in Elkhorn. Hello, Brent.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Well, what can we help you with?
I am a newly formed holistic landscaper in the southeast Wisconsin area and was wondering just if you guys had any advice and kind of, you hit on it before, kind of just convincing customers, but also things beyond prairies, you know, in regards to water retention, edibles, just things that look nice around the property that you think that folks would go for and would sell for a landscaper.
So you are actually selling yourself as a holistic landscaper, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
My advertisement is, you know, garden and landscape service.
Okay.
But
that's your specialty.
Right.
Okay. So people in Elkhorn, Brent is out there. So what can he do to help convince his customers?
Well, you know, a couple of things I would think of would be, you know, you might have the customers that really are into the pollinators, native plants. It's really a hot topic, you know, in horticulture and just our society in general. So you could really sell, you know, the fact that this landscape is not only looking beautiful, but it's also, you know, good for the environment, good for biodiversity. You can, of course, design it so that, you know, it looks pretty and it has those, you know, impacts, like we said, so that it could improve their home value. That's always a good landscape thing.
Very true.
But the other big selling point, I think, would be, you know, and maybe for us, we don't fertilize all our other trees, shrubs, and perennials after they're established, but that's a big thing. It's like really, you know, if you do a good design, not very much maintenance because you really shouldn't need to water it ever again after the first year of establishment. These plants have, you know, been developed in our climate. They've evolved here. You shouldn't have to do any insecticide, any fertilizer. So the idea is it's not no maintenance altogether, but it's like Roy's book, K-N-O-W, maintenance. Mm-hmm. You know what you're getting into. And with that holistic type and incorporating all those native plants, you really don't have to do a lot of work down the road. You can enjoy them. Pretty much you would just either leave them up in the fall for habitat for insects and things to overwinter on, and then, you know, cut it back in the spring and try not to just, like, destroy that debris because you want those things to be able to emerge. Or, like, we cut all our stuff back in the fall and make a big pile of it because we have so many bulbs. We have over 300,000 bulbs at the botanical garden that come up and make this beautiful spring display around Mother's Day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you could really sell, you know, those points of the maintenance side of things, because people a lot of times don't want to do so much work. They want the beauty without the work.
Exactly.
So this could help them get that, maybe.
Exactly. You know, another thing that he might want to think about doing is telling them to go to a botanical garden to see what it's, and actually be in the middle of it. That might help sell it too.
Yeah, right. Or if on your property, maybe have some examples of, you know, what you're going to do into their yard, or, you know, of course you'd have some, you know, pictures and things like that.
You know,
those books, like those books that I mentioned of Noel Kingsbury, mm-hmm. Pete Rudolph, they have some really good examples there and things that you might want to look at to get ideas for your designs too.
Okay. Well, good luck, Brent. We hope that you're successful. Next, we're going to go to St. Francis. Terry? Hi, Terry. What's your question?
Hi. Thank you. I have a question about, I think, a few questions, but specifically, are there some safe herbicides to use near my edibles? I've now planted a couple of grape plants and a raspberry along the fence line, there's a problem. The neighbor's weeds have become our problem. They really grow through the fence. They're very tall, and I'm also trying to strike a delicate balance, as I just really like this neighbor, a sweet person, but she's not a constant gardener. And so this is my second year, and I recognize that she's not going to really probably clean up the garden patch and last planted milkweed. So there's a variety of some flowers and some weeds that are now like 3 and 4 feet tall. So they grow through the fence And I planted along the fence line. This is my son's property, and we kind of negotiated that. Mm-hmm. This year, he mulched and put mulch down. We had put cardboard and mulch to try to contain it. But it really is growing through the fence and blowing through the fence. And so I'm just wondering along the fence line, or is it ever going to pay off? Is there something I can use that would be safe for what I hope will be edibles that will grow there?
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, Terry. Mark, what can she do?
Yeah, well, you can definitely, of course, hand pull the weeds, of course. It's a lot of work.
Of course you can.
You know, one thing I've heard that Melinda Meyer suggested is, like, say you're using, like, glyphosate even. If you take, like, a milk jug or something, you know, that you cut to control where it sprays to, you could, like, spot spray the weeds around your good plants that you like. And that mm-hmm. way you won't have to worry about it drifting onto your other, you know, good plants. And maybe the other thing you could do is maybe your son wants to go over and quick mow her weeds down they don't spread over to your
that's
side of the
thought.
Fence.
That's a really difficult, because, you know, unless she can move her garden to not so close, I mean, that might be a thought too. That's really hard, Terry.
If it's a fence, maybe you can put, you know, some kind of a more permanent, you know, barricade so that the weeds can't squeak through the fence.
True. That's a very good suggestion, too. Good luck, Terry. I don't know. That's all. If anybody has any suggestions that they've actually done in their garden, give us a call. We've been talking with Mark Conlock, the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Find out more about the garden by going to gbbg.org. Stay with us, because there's always more to come on the Ideas Network. It's Friday, so it must be time for Garden Talk on the Larry Mueller Show. Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry today. Our guest is Mark Conlock. He is the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden, and we've been answering your garden questions, and we also started talking about holistic design at the beginning. So, Mark, we were talking a little bit about holistic design at the very beginning. If people are really interested in maybe doing this in their garden, how can they learn more about it? Where would they go?
Yeah, well, there's a couple great resources in the state of Wisconsin.
You know,
Prairie
okay.
Nursery, Neil
okay.
DeBowl. Mm-hmm. If you look at Prairie Nursery's catalog or their website, they have a lot of information about native plants.
Yes.
And then we have Roy Diblick of Northwind Perennial Farms, who really helped design Lurie Gardens with Pete Udolph down at Millennium Park in Chicago. So he's a really good, I mean, you'd have to go to Northwind, but he does have his book called I think it's called No Maintenance, K-N-O-W, Landscaping.
Oh, okay.
So that's kind
mm-hmm.
of a really good resource, because it shows you how to incorporate native plants and ornamental plants together.
Oh, nice.
And there's some really cool books by Pete Udolph and Noel Kingsbury, Planting Design in Space and Time, and they have a plant design book that really kind of talks about their philosophy of, you know, this incorporation of native and ornamental plants together in kind of like a manufactured prairie, if you will.
Okay.
You know, that might be a more longer lasting
right.
thing, like we were talking about with the, you know, versus the prairie versus the, like, design prairie.
Yeah.
So hopefully someday everyone will getting to want to have a prairie in their yard. But a good way to start is incorporating the native plants into your existing landscape.
Sure, and making it look like a design rather than just wild, which some people love, but other people may not be as happy about. So that does kind of get your idea without going completely native.
yeah. And we have some pretty cool ideas of, you know, that at Green Bay Botanical Garden, and there's Old Brick and other gardens that have it. Like, one kind of cool combo to start with is purple coneflower with Primal Scream or Rocket City daylily. So you have that kind of daylily you think of as an ornamental plant,
right.
but it color echoes the interior part of the flower of Echinacea purpurea perfectly, and they bloom at the same time. So it's kind of like a really
beautiful.
Great color ornamental combo, but you're getting mm-hmm. that native plant into the mix for the
right.
habitat and the insect food.
A great idea. I like that. Well, we've got our lines are full, so let's get back over there right away. We've got Susan and Stanley. Susan, thank you so much for holding on for us. What can we help you with?
I have a suggestion for the gardeners who are having trouble with deer and rodents in their, keeping them out of their gardens. What I had learned years ago was that deer will not jump a fence unless there's enough clearance on the other side. So what I did was I installed two fences, in one in my garden and then the other around the outside edge. They didn't jump it. It was very successful.
Okay. Well, Susan, that's just brilliant.
Yeah, that's great advice. Yeah. I've heard that that same advice about the two fences, so I forgot about it. I'm glad you pointed it out because that's a great idea.
And, I mean, if you've got a small lot, obviously that probably won't work.
Right.
But, I mean, for anyone with a larger one, that's a great idea. So thank you so much, Susan, for telling us about that. We appreciate it. Let's go next to Louise in Dodgeville. Hello, Louise. What can we help you with?
Hi, I have a question. I would like to grow corn, not as a crop, but as a ornamental. I actually think it's, like, really beautiful, you know, as it's, like, growing and flowering. So I was wondering, is there a perennial variety? What variety could you recommend? Any soil prep needed? And, just growing it for kind of like a boundary, kind of like a natural fence, if you will.
Sure. Okay, Louise.
Yeah, that's a cool idea. There is an ornamental corn, actually. It's like a striped, I can't remember the cultivar off the top of my head, but we actually trialed some because we're an All-America Selection trial ground. So we trialed an ornamental corn last year, and it didn't do as good as the one that was on the market already, but there is a striped ornamental corn that you could try out. Also, another one is there's a thing called broom corn.
Yes.
You know, that we grow sometimes as an ornamental in our children's garden. And I've heard people using, like, sorghum as a barricade like that. Actually, at UW River Falls, they used it to kind of enclose their vegetable garden. So, yeah, you'd probably do the soil prep, you know, like you would it growing, you know, your other corn crop. I think there's a new All-America Selection edible corn. I should know the name of it because I wrote it for Wisconsin Gardening Magazine, but it's slipping my... I think it's called American Dream, maybe? Maybe it's American Dream. It's a sweet corn, so it'd be an edible one. But yeah, you could... That sounds like a really interesting idea. So just take a look. There are those striped ones on the market, and they would be really cool and different. And some of them have a little bit of... they're white, and then like they have a little bit of a pink in there, so you can kind of color echo your ornamental planting off of there. We've also grown them in a container and used them as like the thriller, you know, in a big container. Mm-hmm. So you can use those corns that way too.
So when you're using them for ornamental, you don't have to worry about having a lot for pollinization, I'm assuming, because with regular corn you do.
Yeah, correct, because you wouldn't be, you know, saving it.
You're not eating it. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Louise. That was a good idea. Up next, we have Dick in Boulder Junction. Hello, Dick.
Hi. I had a problem this spring when the snow left. It was a vole problem. I believe it was a vole. In the prior years, I had small areas of my lawn, and I've got about a 50,000 square foot lawn, and they decimated about 40% of it when spring came and the snow left. How do you control voles?
So, Dick, did you have like the tracks of the voles throughout your lawn?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we actually had a similar thing at the botanical garden. You know. Many times, actually.
really?
It's kind of a little bit of a story. But, you know, a few things. Of course, you know, you could poison them. You know, you have those little, like, PVC pipe things that you can make as a tea and put the bait in there so just the voles will get it versus your other things. The problem with that, of course, is that, you know, it eats it and other animals can eat the voles and then it kind of travels up the food chain. So we don't do that, really. We have a lot of foxes on our property that actually I've seen, you know, jumping into snow and eating the voles. Mm-hmm. So maybe if you don't use the poison over time, you'll get a natural predator depending on what part of, you know, where you live exactly. The red foxes are kind of like, you know, animals that'll go all over the place, edge species that might be able to control them. But the strange kind of thing I was going to tell you was that we used to have the vole tracks throughout the garden, and what we would do is we just raked all that damaged area out, and because of the Kentucky bluegrass and, you know, the grass within there, especially Kentucky bluegrass because it spreads by rhizomes, it would usually fill up all our little vole tracks, even though it looked kind of bad in the beginning of the spring, and we really never overseeded it or anything. It just kind of filled in over time. So maybe, you know, your grass will be able to heal itself, quote unquote. Of course, you could overseed it, you know, and if you really, really, really hate them, you could go the poison route.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have a lot of different ways to deal with that, but good luck, Dick. Mark Conlock is our gardening expert today. He's the director of horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. Next up, we have Jeannie, and she's in Cottage Grove, Minnesota. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi.
What What do you have for us?
We grew radishes this year in our garden, and they were very spicy. And we were just wondering if there's anything you can do in the growing of the radish to make it less spicy.
Oh, well, some people like that, but is it a species kind of a thing?
Yeah, I think different cultivars, you know, might have different spiciness, but I believe also, you know, that the heat can cause the spiciness or the time of the year. So you're going to want to grow them perhaps earlier, you know, start them as early as you can. In Minnesota, that'll probably be June. But I'm just kidding.
Oh, we're going to get calls now.
You start them earlier so they don't, you know, again, get mature during the hotter part of the year. But then you could also look at different, you know, cultivars that are more mild. It should tell you that on the seed pack for the milder ones. And again, AAS has a lot of radishes there.
Right. Let's go next to Marlene. And Marlene is in Wales. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. So I've gotten into monarch butterflies in the last year or so, and I have quite a bit of common milkweed, the taller type, growing in my yard just naturally. Mm-hmm. And I've become aware of a plant called butterfly weed, which has orange flowers, blooms longer, and is shorter. And I wondered if your guest could speak to the advantages and disadvantages of the common milkweed versus the butterfly weed.
Yeah, so both of them are good plants. The common milkweed that you have, you know, I'd say the thing about it is it's pretty aggressive. You know, so a lot of people have actually been leaving it more because it's a lot of times considered a weed more than an ornamental, even though it is, you know, a good plant for the butterflies and other nectar lovers. You know, so but the butterfly milkweed, or there's also a butterfly milkweed for clay from Prairie Nursery. Like you said, more, you know, a smaller plant, a little more restrained, under control, different flower color, you know, can take drier soil and live in pretty harsh environments. There's other milkweeds, too, that you can see in those catalogs for wetter environments or other. There's other looking ones compared to the two that you mentioned, which are the more common ones. So I'd try to leave a little patch of the common milkweed, but because it's so aggressive, you'll have to, like, you know, taper it back to just the area you want. But I definitely think you should, you know, branch out into that butterfly milkweed and try that out too, and I think you'll really like it. And also look at those catalogs for the other milkweeds. There's some really interesting, really dissected or really fine lanceolate leafed ones too that have a different texture that you wouldn't think of as, you know, your common milkweed.
Yeah, it's amazing to me. I always thought, well, there's just one milkweed, but there are a lot actually. So yeah, well, good luck, Marlene. Let's go next to Andrea in Green Bay, and she might be your neighbor. Hi, Andrea.
I am literally your neighbor. My backyard butts up to the botanical garden.
Well, that's rough, Andrea. That's really rough.
Yeah, I know. We'll never have any other neighbors other than the beautiful botanical garden, which is nice. And we get a lot of your turkey and deer in our backyard.
So what's your question?
My question is, we had our house re-sided, and they put all the siding on our lawn in the backyard, which killed the grass. And we really want to get a lawn back, so obviously you must know the soil type there. What would be the best kind of grass to put in?
Yeah, well, we have some really good soil at the garden that's been built up over time, but if you know what was there previously, most, you know, grasses, most of our grass for shade is about 60% fescues, 30% Kentucky bluegrass, and 10% perennial ryegrass. You know, so you want to look for a shade tolerant mix like that that has more fescue than Kentucky bluegrass. The other thing to know, Andrea, is that most sod is actually Kentucky bluegrass and grown in the sun. So you probably don't want to have your yard sodded. You know, instead you'll have to start it from seed. So that would be the thing to do, is look for a shade seed mix. And actually it's getting close to be a really good time to do that, because, you know, September when it's cooler, it is a good time to seed because the soil is still warm, so the seed will germinate fast and grow. But it's not the time when the broadleaf weeds, you know, they've gone through their life cycle, so they usually can be outcompeted by grass quite easily. So the soil is warm, they'll germinate, but then it's also cool in the air. So once it starts growing, that's the kind of conditions that our cool season grasses like. And also it starts to, you know, rain sporadically, not huge downpours that'll wash your seed out, but little rain that'll keep it wet on top and help it grow and get established. So actually, you know, if you want to wait till, say, September-ish, that would be the best time for you to do this project and to reseed that area.
Now, what do you do when you've got a dead lawn and you want to reseed it? What's the process of getting that seed to the ground?
Pretty much what you'll want to do is, you know, rake out all the dead grass, and that'll kind of like scratch up the soil surface. And then you would spread your seed out. Depending on how huge of an area it is, you usually want to like go perpendicular, like, you know, spread it one direction and then walk the other way so you don't have any spots that you don't cover it. And then what we like to do is kind of like lightly rake it in, so about half of the seed is covered by soil and half of it is visible. We usually like use the backside of a yard rake to do that and kind of just go across it.
Okay.
And then usually you want to put maybe a little bit of straw or some type of mulch to hold the moisture in around there. Mm-hmm. And then one of the harder parts maybe is just, you know, keeping it slightly moist, because you just need that seed to take in water, to start growing, to imbibe moisture, to hydrate the organellas and start the radical growing down there. You know, and then you can water less frequently and deeper as it starts to get established. Mm-hmm. And then wait to do your first mowing till it gets to be, you know, four and a half inches, because you only want to cut off really about a third of the leaf blade when you mow. So you really want it to get established. But then you do want to mow it, because then it'll start to tiller out, especially your Kentucky bluegrass,
right,
to get established,
yeah,
by those rhizomes.
But if you have vole problems, then you want it to do that, right? Okay, we'll take one more call here. Cindy in Antioch, Illinois. Hello, Cindy.
Hello. I have two suggestions to solve some of your caller's problems. The first suggestion is regarding deer problems, and I use a product called Deer Out. It's just a concentrate. It comes in a gallon, and you order it. It comes in a gallon, and you mix it up, one part product to 10 parts water, and it's sprayed on, and I've been using it on my hosta and tulips and everything else that my deer have been browsing on for about a decade, and it just works great. But of course, when the plants continue to grow, like the hosta, it does need to be reapplied. But if the plants are at the adult stage, you only need to apply it about once every 3 weeks.
Okay, and what about the radishes, Cindy? We're kind of running down here.
Yeah, radishes would be a French breakfast variety. I've gotten mine from Burpee. There are several other marketers. But French breakfast is a mild version of radish, not spicy at all. So hopefully these ideas will help other people.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you, Cindy. That's what's so great about this show. We all share. Well, Mark, this has gone so fast. For people who want to know about the Green Bay Botanical Garden, where again is what's the website, and whereabouts are you located in Green Bay?
Yeah, check out our website. It's gbbg.org, so the initials of Green Bay Botanical Garden.org. And we're kind of on the west side of Green Bay. If you go on 41 North, you'll get off on Mason to Packerland to Green Bay Botanical Garden.
It's really easy to get to.
Yeah, it's really
and I think there's signs too. There's signs, so. Well, thanks again, Mark. We've been talking with Mark Conlock. He's the Director of Horticulture at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Find out more about the garden again at gbbg.org. Thanks to Dave Potras for technical direction and Kate Archer Kent for on-air production. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network. Thank you so much for listening to us. Stay with us. Chapter A Day is next. I hope you'll be able to get out in the garden this holiday weekend, or maybe you'll be hopping on your bike. Here's a Wisconsin Life piece on just how special that first bike ride can be.
Learning to ride a bike can be a milestone in a person's life. Lately, WPR producer and local dad, Brad Kohlberg, has been thinking about when he first learned how to ride a bike, teaching his daughter to ride, and what biking has meant to his family over the years, all because of a song he recently heard.
There's a band that I've followed on and off since college called Pedro the Lion, and they released a new song a while back called Yellow Bike. It's about getting your first bike and how the world opens up when you learn to ride it. It was a blast of nostalgia for me. It made me think of my first bike, my dad helping me learn to ride, me helping my daughter, and how important bike rides have been for my family over the years.
On a desert Christmas morning, 1981.
I got my first bike on my 6th birthday, a red Murray brand with chrome handlebars and chunky black tires. A bike for popping wheelies and doing sweet jumps. I loved it.
My first two-wheel bicycle stood by the tree. My heart thumping in my chest. Though I tried, I couldn't ride one yet.
The other neighborhood kids rode their bikes around in a little pack all day, and I really wanted to join. But I was embarrassed of the training wheels. So I begged, and my dad took them off, and I ran around pushing my bike beside me, trying to keep up with him. I couldn't. During practice sessions, my dad ran alongside me, gave me a nudge, and let go of the seat. I'd coast, try to pedal, crash into the neighbor's mailbox. I even ran over my little brother one day when he wandered into my path and I couldn't steer around him. Sorry, Dave.
But I remember what it was like astride my yellow bike. First freedom, second life, all the places I could ride.
A friend had a bike that was smaller than mine, and my feet could easily touch the ground when I sat on it, which made it easier to coast. I'd ease down my driveway on his bike with my feet dangling to see how far I could go. One afternoon, I put my feet up and started pedaling. And I took off. I was riding. I still feel a little sad that my dad was at work when it finally happened. Sorry, Dad. But I didn't look back. The neighborhood became infinite. A motocross track, a battlefield, a movie set. All the money I made at my first job picking sweet corn went to building better bikes for bigger jumps. And I spent every summer day riding around town with my friends until I got to high school, when it became kid stuff, like overnight. My BMX gathered dust and was forgotten. Fast forward 25 years, and I was running beside my daughter in the church parking lot up the street as she learned to ride her first bike.
Okay, you ready? One, two, three. Go, go, go!
I gave her a nudge, let go of the seat, and watched her pull away from me and turn the corner out of sight. Now she's almost 14, and my old bag of tricks doesn't really work anymore. Legos, backyard baseball, trips to the playground. But she still rides around the neighborhood with me after dinner.
Dad, how long have you been videoing?
We talk a lot while we ride, and sometimes we keep the conversation going with some ice cream afterward. It's the greatest. So when I heard that Pedro the Lion song, you know what I did? I went out and got myself a new BMX bike. A bike for popping wheelies and doing sweet jumps. Because sometimes dads and kids aren't that different. And I feel like a kid when I ride it, with my daughter beside me. It's the greatest.
I trade my kingdom for someone to ride with.
Brad Kohlberg is a producer for WPR in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.